You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Robert Greene. He is the author of the, I don't know how many millions of copies you sold of the 48 Laws of Power.
1.2 million.
1.2 million copies of 48 Laws of
Power. More than that. More.
All right. Take it easy. Don't be greedy. The 48 Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, both books I've read. The 33 Strategies of War, The 50th Law and Mastery, which I think 50 Cent came to you about.
No, the 50th Law is I actually wrote it with 50 Cent.
You wrote it with 50 Cent, which I want to get into. But your latest book, Mastery.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, I guess it's doing pretty well. And I like the cover a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you are the 48 Laws of Power. Just to start with, was recommended to me by this by a badass Special Forces guy and somebody I've known, one of the smarter guys.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's read this book. Everybody's read this book, and it's. We'll start with that. We'll get to Mastery, but I want to talk about the 48 Laws of Power because it's kind of, I'm sure it was a surprise to you that it had such resonance. In some ways, it's the manual for the sociopath. I mean, I mean, you could say that it's sort of how it's pretty cynical, and this is how you gain power. You use a lot of great examples. I mean, you have a real command of history, and you use a lot of historical examples in the book, which I loved. But I guess what I loved about it, and I also kind of what disturbed me about it, was how true it felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say it, but that is kind of like, if you want to get ahead in the world, you at least should have a sense of how these things work. And
right.
Why did you write this book? What got you thinking about this book? Besides to dominate the world.
Well, actually, I'm more on the side of someone who was a bit naive.
Mm.
I had entered the work world like everybody else, you know, imagining that it was just a place where people would get work done and get results, and results are what mattered. And suddenly I'm realizing, no, it's about ego and people's insecurities and politicking and creating factions. And I worked in many different places. I've had my girlfriend and I counted, over 60 different jobs in a relatively short period of time. I've seen everything, a lot of it in Hollywood. And I just was really inspired to write a book that wasn't out there.
Mm.
People write all of these self-help books. You go to the bookstore, you look on Amazon, there's like millions of them, but they don't reflect reality.
Mm.
They don't reflect the reality that I saw. When the boss closes the door, he or she is making phone calls, doing things that nobody is describing or writing about. It's like a dirty little secret. So I wanted to reveal the secret. I wanted to say this is what really goes on in the realms of power. You know, people manipulate.
Mm.
And I had also made some critical mistakes in my life. Law number one is never outshine the master. And the idea is that your boss, the person above you, has an ego. They're insecure. You may not realize it because you think they're the boss, they're all powerful, but they actually have insecurities. And if you try too hard to please them, they might start thinking that you're after their job, or that perhaps you're better than they are. People like you more than they like him or her.
Your example in the book is riveting, just about the king and the guy who throws that lavish party and ends up. And all your examples are based on true historical fact. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just the guy wants to impress the king with a great party so that maybe the king will put him in a higher position. And in fact, the king is worried now that people like this man giving the party more than they like him, Louis XIV, and he's put in prison the rest of his life. Anyway, I have made that mistake in my life. I have outshone the master. I've been fired. Nobody tells you that's the reason they're firing you. So I wanted to give the world a dose of reality. I was so sick of all the books that kind of soft pedal what's really going on in the world, try and make out that everyone's just an angel, that we all are just compassionate and cooperative. Just not the reality.
Yeah.
We have an animal nature. We are the Machiavellian primate, as many writers have demonstrated. And it's not a book for sociopaths. I disagree with that. Mm. The sociopaths don't need the 48 laws of power. It's wired in their DNA. Let's say they're 5 or 6% of the population have that kind of narcissistic mentality where they don't care about other people. They don't need a book.
Right.
They could write the book.
Yeah.
It's the other people like me, perhaps like you, who don't understand that.
Be ready for it. Be ready for the sociopath in a way, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
some of the things you're going to want to practice, maybe it's not all hard-ass stuff in the book.
Right.
But you want to be aware of what other people might be doing to you. Did I answer your question?
Very much so.
Okay.
Very much so. I think it's really important to know that. Otherwise, you're a pawn. And yeah. I think that's probably one of the reasons that the book resonates, because it's one thing, you know, usually you get found out. If you write a flashy book, people are going to read it, and it's going to. But when you sell as many copies as you have, it's resonating, and it's resonating deeply because it's touching on the truth of the human animal, a large part of the human animal, anyway.
Yeah.
You can't ignore the fact that we have a will to power, to quote Nietzsche. You know, it's true. Everything is a power dynamic. Everything is. I mean, male-female relationships, all of it is.
Yeah.
Physical inequality is a fact. Mental inequality, many times, is a fact. I mean, you get in there, and somebody's just got more experience, and they're able to teach you and things like that. So
yeah,
I think that's the value. I love the same thing went for seduction as well. What is the 50th law in mastery? You wrote that with 50 Cent.
Oh, you mean the 50th law?
Yeah.
Basically what happened there, just to give you a little backstory, is the first book, The 48 Laws of Power, was really big with the hip hop world.
Yeah. Was that surprising?
Yeah, very surprising. Since I was a kid, I love African-American culture, music-wise, literature, the whole thing. But I never intended the book to resonate with the rap, hip-hop community. I like hip-hop, but it's not like my main passion in life.
Yeah.
So I was surprising. But it has a logic, which is basically when the book came out, there was a big movement among rappers to become kind of entrepreneurs. Because musicians, and particularly black musicians, are heavily exploited. They have no control over what they produce. They're given a pittance of the money that ends up being made. And so there was a big movement, somewhat inspired by Tupac, to become actually the owners of their own music, what they produced. And they don't. None of these people have business backgrounds. I'm talking about the managers and the artists themselves. And so they found the book very helpful because, as 50 later told me, you know, he was a hustler on the streets. He was dealing crack on the streets of Queens. Nothing in that world prepared him for the music industry. It was so much harder, so much sharkier, so much rougher.
Wow.
Because you never knew.
And he got shot 9 times.
Yeah. And he said that after he got shot 9 times. You never knew which side people were on. They would be friendly and nice. They would offer you this. And then a month later, they would, you know, turn
against
you.
I know nothing about that, living in Hollywood for 20 years.
Oh, God. Yeah. Hollywood is like the minor leagues for the music industry.
Wow.
I mean, as far as comparing the level of gamesmanship. But Hollywood's pretty bad. Anyway, so the book helped them deal with this very sharky environment. It was kind of like their business book, so to speak. So 50 came to me. It was about 2005, just to meet me. And we met in New York in a back room of a steakhouse. I said before it was sort of reminded me like something out of The Godfather.
Yeah.
Because he was with his whole entourage and I was this one little, you know, thin white guy. For a second, I was wondering if I was going to get, you know, if something was going to happen to me.
Yeah.
But it was fine. And he was great. And he was really, really nice person. He's not what you think he is.
Yeah.
He's
just a good guy and a smart guy.
Yeah.
A surprise.
He's very sweet.
Yeah.
You wouldn't really associate that word with 50, I imagine. And we had a good rapport. We think alike. When somebody does something, our tendency is to analyze what's their power game, what are they up to?
Mm.
And he's got a mind like that. So we decided we'd write a book together. And I gave myself the idea that I've been writing books that deal with dead people, essentially. You know, Napoleon, Louis XIV, they're all dead. I was going to study 50 as a living example of the 48 laws of power. Mm. And I was going to decide after spending 3-4 months tied to his hip, what makes 50 50? And that would be the law to show people this is how you could emulate someone like that. And I decided basically the guy's fearless. But it's not a fearlessness that's what you normally associate.
It's not a bravado. It's kind of more of a, not a reckless fearlessness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's more like he's not afraid of failure. He's not afraid of being alone. He's not afraid of making mistakes. He's not afraid of confronting his own weaknesses.
Something really dramatic I never forgot in an interview. He said, I bled all my fear out in the back of that cab.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I just went, man, that's a man right there. That is a man. And if and it doesn't surprise me he's a sweet guy, because if you listen to a lot of his music, there's a lot of heart in that music, man.
There is.
You've got to touch into your artistic side. I mean, guns and being hard is something he had to be.
Yeah.
I don't think that's who he is at his core. I think that becomes exhausting after a while.
I mean, I don't want to paint him as a complete pussycat, because I could see in moments there's another side to him.
Mm-hmm.
It would flash
mm-hmm.
where you could see where the guy could be incredibly tough.
I bet.
But generally, I think you're right. He's at his heart, he's kind of a really warm person.
Hmm.
So, you know, that was after deciding that was sort of the secret to success, the fact that he can walk in a meeting with heavy people in some business and not really care whether the deal falls through because he's got other things going on, and that attitude of, you know, okay, it's all right if it doesn't come.
You reach for me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is really, really powerful. So that's sort of, the book's a meditation on that.
Having meditated on the book, having written the book, do you think it's affected your friendships, your relationships? You know, and let me couch that in another example. I love dogs. Always love dogs.
I noticed.
Yeah, it's those aren't mine. Those are our producers. But I love dogs. I've always had them. And you know. When somebody one time said, well, dogs are three things, a dog trainer said. They're scavengers, hunters, and pack animals. They've evolved to manipulate you in their own way. That's how they get to you. I kind of went, I looked at my dog a little differently. I kind of went, well, I'm being manipulated here. This dog's not really being friendly. The dog wants something from me. And I had to kind of check myself, because for about a week there, I wasn't being very nice to my dog. I was like, this dog's just using me. And that's a cynical bullshit way to look at dogs. But, you know, come on, man. They're just like them. They're fucking adorable. But I will say that I think I've read the book twice, actually, The 48 Laws of Power. It is easy. Do you find yourself kind of being more cynical with the way you look at people, or no? It hasn't affected your.
It has affected me, but it hasn't made me more cynical. It's made me more tolerant.
Mm.
Particularly, I mean, things have changed. The book came out 16 years ago, but when I was writing, and particularly afterwards, it just made me more tolerant. And the idea is that. We are this sort of animal. We are animals, you know. And we come with a certain biological makeup.
Yeah.
We don't like the feeling of not having power. You can see it in a child. You know, children could be very manipulative.
Very much so.
The sense of being weak or dependent is very, very miserable for a human being and every human. And so in some way, on some level, we struggle to gain some level of control over our husband, wife, colleague, boss, whatever, whomever it is. And so thinking of it that way, I can look at myself and I can see that I do that. I can be manipulative at times. And so it's just our nature. And it actually makes me very much more tolerant than a lot of other people are. I can understand why a boss gets this way, or how difficult it is to be a leader in the world today, or why someone might end up becoming a sociopath. It just makes me much more tolerant. I don't feel like it made me more cynical. And the thing is, like with your dogs, you know, you could easily say, oh, well, they're manipulating me. They're using me, but I'm using them.
Right.
Yeah.
And think of what you're using them for.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing about how you read the 48 Laws of Power, because very often people read the 48 Laws of Power and are looking at, oh, how should I be interacting with people? How should I be using people? But the other option is to read it as an opportunity to know thyself, to really understand this is something that exists in me. It exists in other people. It's an aspect of human nature that exists in all of us.
It touches also on my political point of view. Like somebody asked me what am I, and I said I tend to lean just more libertarian, because I think human beings from a very early age, I mean, a child wants its own sovereignty. They want their own power over themselves. I think human beings, no matter where they are, want some say in who governs them. I think they want, you know, they want to be able to choose their mate. They want to be able to choose. They want to be able to speak their mind and worship who they want. Those are natural. They are wired into our DNA.
Yes.
And so, you know, for me, I always feel like any other political system, anytime you have a coercive political system, you know, the bigger government gets, I feel like it is working against our human nature. I feel like you do need some regulation, you need laws and things. But this book, the 48 Laws of Power, had an effect on me that way. It had an effect on my political philosophy.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, well, this is what happens when you get on my podcast. I'm brilliant. I mean, finally, we've established that. I always have to get the upper hand, Robert Green.
Sorry.
No, not at all. But it did. It highlighted, illuminated, dilated on the fact that is, you do a very good job of arguing for the fact that people want their own sovereignty and life is a power play.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know that, then that it behooves a political system and structure to give people as much sovereignty over themselves as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Let them figure it out on their own. Talk about mastery. This is your new book.
Yeah. Well, basically, it came out of the fact that I've spent, many, many years studying really powerful, successful people, a lot of them dead, but I've also been a consultant I'm on the board of directors of a publicly traded company, and I do a lot of consulting. And I noticed a pattern that people seem to follow when they become very successful. They go through a certain process, and it has nothing to do – their success has nothing to do with their genetics or where they went to school or how nice their parents were to them. It had to do with something else, much more fundamental, and nobody talks about it. I said, nobody talks about the power game. Nobody talks about this. We see someone who's very powerful and successful, like a 50, and we don't understand all of the work and the process and the hard work that went into becoming who they are. I want to describe to you, the reader, the process that is involved in this and demystify it. Has nothing to do, it's not Einstein born with a high IQ. No, Einstein put in the 10,000 hours. I can show you those 10,000 hours. And what it means is it's something that's accessible to everyone. The key is you choose a career or a profession that you love. That's like the starting point for everything in life, in my opinion. What I call a vocation, your calling in life. If you do that right, then all of the hard work, the 10,000 hours, they don't feel like work. They're a pleasure.
You're following your curiosity.
Yeah. And then you reach this point, which I call mastery. And what I believe mastery is it's a higher form of intelligence. It's not an intellectual intelligence. It's a practical intelligence. It's the kind of intelligence a Michael Jordan has after he's played for so many years, or Tiger Woods. It's the intelligence that a great chess player has, or a musician. It can be an intellectual intelligence. It doesn't have to be. It's the result of so many years of practice that you have a feel for what you're doing. Like you have a feel for what you're doing on your podcast. Mm-hmm. That's mastery. And
in bed.
Yeah. Okay.
Brian, he just said you reached mastery.
Thank you. Yeah. I do feel that way. I was talking to Hunter about being a comic for as long as I've been.
Oh, I didn't know.
I'm a stand-up comic. So, and I travel all over the country and in Canada. And I'm on tour now. I'm getting ready to shoot my second special. And when you've been doing the reason that I became a comic was, I think, because I grew up all over the world. And I was put in different situations every 2 years or whatever, where I'd have to meet a whole new group of people, different language, and all that. And I had to learn very quickly how to sort of adapt to a new set of circumstances.
Right.
You do that as a guy two ways. You make people laugh, or you're good at sports. I was okay at sports, but I was better at being a jackass. And I learned how to negotiate. By the time I was 14, I remember that was in a chairlift, a big cable car.
Uh-huh.
And with my dad, we were skiing, and there were these two girls, these sexy girls, and I started talking to them. And by the time that we got there, I had made plans with these girls. My father said, I don't know how you – that was smooth. He goes, I don't know how the hell you
communicate. You were 14?
Yeah. He goes, I've never seen anybody communicate the
way
– I know. And it hadn't occurred to me, but what did occur to me later on as I hear about that story was I'd been doing that since I was 6 years old. I'd been doing that since I was three. I had learned very quickly how to – and so now for a job, I get up on stage in front of 200, 300, 400 strangers, and I have to make them laugh for an hour. you've got to get on their frequency right away and figure it out. And one of the things we talked to Hunter about, who wrote a book called The Straight Edge Conspiracy, about this kind of thing, similar thing, about the learning process. And
specifically about the idea that people are born smart, which is essentially what you're talking about is that, you know, we believe that Einstein was just born to be a physicist or whatever, and we don't understand that 10,000 hours, the path to mastery.
What's your book called?
The Straight Edge Conspiracy.
Wow.
It's a great book.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a great book. Okay. And doing very well, by the way.
Yeah,
and
moving along.
Some big things happening, which we'll talk about off air. But you know, for me, it dawned on me. I told Hunter the story that I feel like, you know, when I was doing stand up, and I realized that I felt like I was pushing air in and taking air out of the audience. I was pacing my comedy so I didn't get them too tired. Can't get them laughing a lot in the beginning.
Yeah.
Those are dynamics. Or one side of the audience is a little low energy and I got to bring attention to them. And you're playing the audience almost like an instrument.
Yeah.
I'd never thought I could even talk that way. But when you've been doing something as long as I have, it's a wonderful place to go. I mean, you know, really... 20.
Wow,
I mean,
fantastic.
Yeah.
But in a certain sense, since you were six. And I think that's one of the interesting things is that so long people are practicing and doing these things long before they make the formal decision to embark on the path.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so and for me, I remember trying to be a banker. And that was the interruption. And I literally started getting physically ill. I remember thinking, you mean at the end of the day, my life is going to be a number? I made some shareholders richer? I don't even understand how to put that into context, but I know it ain't what I want to do.
Yeah.
I just want to be a silly goose, or I want to do something poetic like Springsteen or what De Niro did in Raging Bull, whatever.
Yeah.
But there it is, following you get a deeper acumen, a deeper understanding.
I'm just really curious, what did you do with those when you were 14 with those girls? But I mean, what was it? How did you charm them, or what is just being funny?
Just being funny. I think just kind of, I probably, you know, it's something probably, if I, you know, I don't remember, but I'm sure it was probably something like, we're going to get pants like that. Those pom-poms are awesome on your boots.
Really?
I just can't, my legs are too muscular to fit into that. I'm very muscular. You can't tell because I'm wearing, you know, whatever. I was saying, probably just pretty joking around. But getting them laughing is always the... is the way to go. You know, that's
which, by the way, I mean, that is a way to power. I mean, that's essentially, that's what you're using comedy to break down their usual script, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I got married and my father-in-law called me up and he said, so I was listening to Howard Stern and Artie Lang said that you were the best he'd ever seen with women. And I was like, well, that's not good on Howard Stern. Oh, that was before when I was single. I was just a guy, you know, it got a little contentious there. My wife never heard about it. I was like, and that's not true, by the way. I think Artie was being dramatic. But you know.
There are many people in the stand-up comedy community and the MMA community who feel that you are the best that they've ever seen.
Oh, come on, man. No, I'm just charming. Robert's already turned on and he's a straight man.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
He's going to rewrite the Book of Seduction. Me on the cover.
I don't think there's a 49th law of power. You could be the 49th law of power.
That's right.
Listen, when you're a regular looking guy, you better use humor. You got to know how to pull bunnies out of a hat, you know?
Oh, you're not a bad looking guy.
Thanks.
It's a great story because it's exactly illustrating what I'm talking about in mastery. Mm. Like, I go in the book and I show with almost all of the people that I profile in the book, I also interview 9 contemporary masters along with the dead ones. Mm. Is it at a certain age, they feel like there's I call it like a voice inside your head that draws you to certain activities that you know you're good at. And the difference between them and most people is other people stop hearing that voice. They start listening to their parents who tell you, you got to go to law school, you got to go to med school. They listen to their friends who say, oh, you need to go into rock or do this or that or the other. They start listening to teachers and they don't hear that voice inside their head saying, this is what you really should be doing. And that's the only difference. It's not their IQ or anything else. That by following that voice, by saying, I'm great at comedy, I like making people laugh, it's what I'm good at, you're able to put up with all the tedium, the criticism, the roughness. I'm sure you've had a lot of tough times in your life.
Yeah.
You've also made a wrong decision going into banking, which is a common theme with all of these successful people. It's that wrong decision that shows you what the right path is, and then you correct it.
Mm.
But that's the only difference between people who really, really make it and those who don't. They stop listening to themselves.
Because a lot of these people from a very young age, you know, Wayne Gretzky would stare at the TV at 2 years old when his parents would turn the TV off. when he was watching hockey, he would break into tears, right? I mean, follow your...
Yeah.
That's an example of sort of... He was so interested in... He was so fascinated for whatever reason by that game.
Yeah.
If you hear Josh Waitzkin talking about chess, he's the guy who they wrote... He wrote a very good book called The Art of Learning.
I met him just a couple weeks ago.
He's great. And he... the book is called The Art of Learning, and he basically compares, you know, chess. He was... It was what the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer written about him. And he said from a very early age, he just was the board looked familiar to him.
Yeah.
You know, and he followed that. And of course, he translated that art of learning, the mastery he got in chess into jujitsu and draws those cool.
Now he's in business. He's working.
When he was practicing one thing, he was practicing the other. He had mastered both.
Well, but that's because really that's the point is all practice works in the same way. And the mistake that for so long we've lived under the illusion that, you know, different subjects are different and they, you know, you can have an aptitude in one and not in another, right? And that essentially genetics is the key to greatness as opposed to emotion, right? It's really, it's feelings that drive us on the path to mastery because 10,000 hours is a long ass time.
Yeah.
And if you don't have, you know, passion driving that, you're going to crap out at some point along the way.
Well, we had Dan Quayle on, who wrote The Talent Code, which is...
Not Vice President Dan Quayle.
No, not Dan. Dan Quayle. Not Dan Quayle. Dan Quayle. Dan Quayle.
Quayle.
Yeah, okay. Different name, but yes. I don't know that Dan Quayle would be that interesting. Yeah. I don't know if he's... All due respect to
His
Dan
spelling
Quayle.
Is interesting.
Right, yeah. Right. I'm sure he'd be. He's got some interesting
Okay, Dan
but
Quayle.
But a lot of that was what he calls deep practice.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about, I mean, you touch on a lot of different things, but what of the contemporary masters, or the contemporary masters, was there anybody who stood out who is somebody who... Maybe you just were more blown away with by, or just.
I was blown away with by all of them, but a good example was that I liked a lot is Freddie Roach. I don't know if you're familiar with Freddie.
Very much so. Yeah.
Okay, so he's.
I'm going to box with Wayne McCullough, who's a world champion. In right after this. So
really,
When I say go to box, I'm going to.
You're going to this gym.
I'm
going to
go get beat up by him.
The Hollywood gym.
No,
gym.
I'm going to be down at Box and Burn.
Oh.
And I'm going to go when you move around with a world champion who is now 42 and probably 140 pounds, 5'6". Well, and when you realize what he can do to you, what he can do, because it's a language he's mastered.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why are you doing this?
Because I like being humiliated.
Okay.
And it just makes me feel. I like learning. I mean, that's because I like getting more fluent in a language.
That's great. Yeah. Well, the thing about Freddie was he's a really great example of what I'm talking about because essentially his father forced all of the boys, there were three boys, to go into boxing at the age of 4. You know, he put gloves on the kids. And at the age of 6, he was already training in a ring, Freddie. And he wasn't really that good. He had an older brother who was sort of better. And he's training all through his life. And by the time he's like 15 or 16, his mother says to him, Freddie, why are you doing this? You're not even really very good at it. And he got so irritated by his mother saying that he went back into the gym and he started practicing double hard. And he ended up getting a little bit better than his brother and then much better than his brother. And then finally he got on the Olympic team and then he turned pro. And he was a good pro, particularly in the beginning, but he wasn't great.
Right.
He took a lot of punches.
A lot of wars.
He was somebody that just, once he got in the ring, all of his training and practice just flew out and he just went on emotion.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'm just going to beat the shit out of this person. But then he took so many blows that he started getting not so good. And he was really forced to retire at the age of 26.
Right.
And basically, at that point, it looks like he's done. Because all of his life has been boxing. He doesn't know anything else, has no education, really. And so he's in Vegas where he'd been training, and he starts working as a telemarketer, and he's drinking heavily. And, you know, he's just like on a path to suicide or something.
Yeah.
And he wanders back into the gym where he used to train with a famous trainer whose name for some reason escapes me right
Eddie
now.
Fudge? Or?
Eddie Fudge. Thank you, man. Great.
Don't worry about that.
How can you forget a name like Eddie Fudge?
Eddie Fudge.
Just saying it, Fudge.
Yeah. I studied you, Robert Green.
Oh, keep going. Okay.
We come prepared.
I thought you hadn't read the book.
No, we come prepared. Okay.
So he goes back to the gym with Eddie Fudge, and he realizes a lot of the boxers aren't getting personal training or attention. So he goes and he starts helping them out, saying, oh, you should do this, you should do that. And he comes back the next day, the next day, he's not getting paid or anything, and Eddie Futch isn't even asking him to do it. But he realizes, wow, this is what I love. Mm-hmm. It's not boxing, because boxing, I'm taking a beating, and my dad forced me to do it. I really wasn't it. I'm competitive. I'm the most competitive man on the planet. I can't stand losing, but I love the teaching of it,
mm-hmm.
you know? I like somebody else enacting what I have to say, and I've learned. So basically, he's had the 10,000 hours of boxing, and now he's a trainer. And being a boxer, he knows things that no other trainer knows
mm-hmm.
because he's put in so much practice. He has a feel for the ring. He said he could close his eyes and he could pinpoint exactly where he is on the ring.
Wow.
You could spin him around. Yeah. He knows the ring like it's inside his body.
Yeah.
He can impart that now to all of his boxers that he's ended up training, like Manny Pacquiao and even MMA artists, fighters, etc. It's a great story because when you arrive at that point where you have 10,000, I say he's got 20,000 hours.
Yeah, easily. Yeah.
You're not thinking anymore. You just know, you have a feel for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can chunk large pieces of information.
Yeah.
That's what happens. It's pattern recognition.
Yeah.
You know, great chess masters are not cognitively any better than you and I necessarily, but
right.
what they have seen is every possible game,
yeah.
every possible move, every yeah. possible. It's exactly like rolling in jiu-jitsu with a guy who's really good. When you start moving, he's been there.
Yeah.
Oh, I know what he's going to do, and he's countering you.
Yeah.
When you play tennis against a great tennis player, they are literally, they can see by the way you are about to hit the ball where the ball's going to go. They're already moving in that direction.
Yeah. But
so it breaks down the mystery, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
mastery is what? It's putting in the correct practice.
Yes,
too,
right. it is. Yeah. Yes.
And that's one of the things that really comes out in the book about Roach's story as well that I thought was interesting is how much of a difference it made for him to be in the ring receiving the punches
yeah.
from the yeah. boxer, because he got to really feel
doing
what was going
it, because
on.
Because there's a
yeah.
doing, right?
Well, he evolved a whole system of training with mitts where he doesn't, most trainers just sit on the sidelines and watch.
Mm-hmm.
He actually gets in the ring with the fighter wearing these large mitts. He's got Parkinson's disease,
yep.
so he's got, you know, he can't take blows anymore to the head. But he's wearing these mitts and he's boxing in the ring with the fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And Manny Pacquiao came to the States in 2000, 2001, sometime around then, to try and see if he could make it in the States. I forget if he was a bantamweight or what classification he was in. And nobody was interested in him because he just there's no money in that kind of classification,
yep.
et cetera. But Freddie Roach was in the ring with him, and he felt the punches.
Wow.
And he said, there's a punch I have never, in all of my experience.
Yeah.
I trained Mike Tyson for a while. He
yep.
did.
Yep.
I had never felt a punch snap like that.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the other trainers viscerally could feel that. So he
and
said,
he
I'm
could.
Taking I'm
he
taking
could.
Manny on.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, they say that about Pacquiao. I remember they said, I can deal with his technique. I can't deal with his speed.
Yeah.
He was so blindingly fast. And the problem was that when you get ready for a fight, you pay sparring partners and you try to get good sparring partners. You ain't getting anybody who can mirror Manny Pacquiao.
Yeah,
so when
no.
you get into that ring, all of a sudden you were jogging and now you're in a sprint.
Particularly someone who's left-handed.
Oh, Jesus. Now
yeah.
you're like, this guy hits so much harder than I thought and yeah. I can't anticipate because I'm not. It's literally like, and fast forward. Here we go. Ready?
Yeah.
You're listening on this speed. Let's move it at this speed. And
right.
it's, you're
well,
done.
And also, I mean, Pacquiao and Roach really broke down the traditional mentor relationship
yeah.
where it's not top-down. It was very much a collaborative
yeah.
relationship, right?
What did you learn in writing this book in terms of, you set
well,
out to write this book, but were there certain discoveries in researching this book that surprised you, or did you already kind of know a lot of this stuff?
Well, I had an intuition about it,
mm-hmm.
But knowing this sense of vocation, of feeling like you're called to something, where it ends up being an emotional quality that separates you from others, so that you're so attached to a problem or to discovering something or to building something that you just tune out all of the criticism, all of the naysayers, all the people who are, and you're able to be alone and practice on your own because you're so emotionally connected to it. But
you're not lonely. You're
not lonely.
You don't need people necessarily.
You know, you
yeah.
enter a state of what they call flow.
Yeah.
Where you're, and so the world just disappears when you're in that. But what was interesting that happened to me, was in writing the book, I had written four chapters. There are six chapters in the book, and I had two left. And the publishers suddenly came back to me and say, we love this book, but you're so late in delivering it that we're going to probably have to postpone it and maybe cancel the project because we just don't know when you're going to finish it. But if you want to have it published in the fall, like we said we would do, you can finish it in 11 weeks, then we're okay. And, you know, I go, I can't write the two most important chapters in this book on creativity and mastery in 11 weeks. It took me like a year to write everything else.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I'm exhausted. I can't do it. And so for 3 days, I was whining and bitching to myself, and I was miserable, and I just was just the worst person to be around. And then finally, I decided, I got to try. Mm-hmm. I have nothing to lose. I've got to try because I can't give up on all that I put into it. For 11 weeks, I worked harder than I have ever in my whole life.
God.
Just night and day, morning, noon. I just was relentless, and it was the best thing that could have happened to me because I got so – it was such an intense level that ideas were coming to me left, right, and center. And I was writing about that in Chapter 5 and 6 about the intensity.
So the last two chapters were submit to the other and synthesize all forms?
Oh. No, chapters 5 and 6.
Oh, 5 and 6.
Yeah.
So widen your vision?
No.
Brian, sorry. You can remember the names of boxing coaches, but numbers.
Oh, you're talking here. Okay, awaken the dimensional mind.
Yes.
The creative active.
Yes, thank you.
And then, yes, and then fuse the intuitive with the rational.
Yes.
Mastery.
Yes, and so I was getting intuitive on writing that chapter because I was sleeping and dreaming it. I'd wake up and go to shower. Whoa, that idea. They were coming to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to think anymore. But that's what I was writing about because I had to do everything in 11 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of an interesting experience.
Well, that's almost like an act of faith. It's like you start, it kind of almost starts to write itself, right? It starts to make sense, all the things that you're doing. The writers talk about that a lot.
Well, it's also constraints. I think in general, that's one of the big things is that people think that creativity comes from like having no boundaries or anything like that.
Mm.
And, you know, if you look at poetry, the whole point is that whatever the language is, they find out how to put constraints on what can be said. In Japanese, it's haiku. There are syllable structures. In English, because it's a rhyming language, you have rhyme and all of that sort of stuff and meter. Rhyme doesn't make sense, particularly in Spanish, because everything ends in an O or an A, right? But whatever the language is, they find these constraints, and that's what forces the creativity.
This smart guy.
Well, biochem major from Harvard speaks about nine languages and wrote a great book. But your book is similar in terms of, I mean, what got you to, you feel very strongly. You always say that the worst idea ever is that some people are born smart. And in fact, it's exactly what Robert's saying is what dictates your pace of learning, and even if you do learn, is the emotional state you arrive at something in.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's because really what people think of emotions as these very fuzzy things, but they have very specific neurological consequences. And one of the things they do is that they're basically the on and off switch for your attention. They open up or close down your attention. So fear shuts down your attention so that you're unable to learn. And joy, you know, curiosity, all of these things open it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, for me, that was a huge, huge surprise in writing our book because, you know, I come from a very scientific background. And so I approached it from, these kids are talking about genes. There's no scientific evidence for that. We just have to dispel that myth. But in the process, what we discovered as we went through the literature, the real thing is emotions, which, of course, that's the irony. That's why, you know, we're so often blinded to that is because, you know, a lot of the people who focus on this stuff are so focused on their rationality. They fetishize their rationality.
I mean, the example I give to people is, which you probably can relate to, is let's say you have to learn French in school or a language. And, you know, you're in high school or in college, and what a drag. And you go... And you're there for an hour, and you're not tuning in at all. And you could go learn that for 4 years, and you could hardly say one sentence once you arrive in France. You know, it's just forget it. But let's say you go to France, and you meet a girl there, and you want to have, you know, seduce her or whatever, and you got to get a job, and suddenly you have to learn French, and you're there. You're so motivated to learn that every day you're picking things up and you're just, your eyes are open and you're absorbing it. You can learn, and I know because I speak languages and I know because I speak French. You can learn in 1 month what took you 10 years at the Absolutely. University because you're motivated. And so when you're motivated and when you're excited, suddenly you're paying attention. The level of attention that you're paying is three times as before. And when you're paying attention, that's when things get absorbed in long-term memory and chunks are starting to accumulate, mm-hmm. et cetera. They're not accumulating. I remember when I was in university, I had to graduate, I had to pass a pharmacology class because I had to do a science. I memorized 10,000 drugs and what they do in a space of 3 weeks. I can't remember one drug,
right,
you know?
Right, because it's not relevant.
Yeah.
Well, because you don't care.
What about the idea when you talk about mastery? What about the idea that you can tend to be too narrowly focused as a human being? So if you have children and you want your kids to be really good at something, this is something I'm interested in because I have a 2.5-year-old and a 6-year-old. Well, and I'm about to choose the school, whether it's Montessori school, which I like.
That's a good school.
Yeah, follow your curiosity. It's the kind of stuff you were talking about. Is there a danger that you can that people have you in your study of the living masters? Did you find that they were very narrow? Did you find that they were maybe human beings you wouldn't necessarily want to be around?
Not at all.
The opposite.
Not at all. What I try to say in the book is everybody is different. Mm. There is literally a spectrum. Mm-hmm. Some people their brains are wired for specialization. A lot of men happen to be better at specialization than women. And there's good biological evolutionary reasons for that. Not all, but that's just sort of a generalization we can make. People who are a little bit on the Asperger spectrum, they're specializers. But there are other people who don't like to specialize. It's literally, what I said earlier, knowing who you are. So I have an example in the book of Contemporary Master of a man who's one of the great neuroscientists of our time, a man named Ramachandran, a complete specialist. He specializes on the narrowest brain disorders that exist. And then there's another woman named Yoki Matsuoka who is a generalist. She just can't stand specializing. She gets bored. She feels narrow and constricted. So she studied electrical engineering, and then she got interested in robotics, and then she decided she just studied neuroscience and then biology, getting PhDs in all of these different fields. And eventually she's
amazing,
creating a new form of technology that's literally smart, like a prosthetic hand that's like a human hand or a thermostat that thinks like a human brain. So it depends on who you are, and it depends on who your children are. The best thing for parents are to encourage your children in their natural inclinations. So you might love football, but your son, he wants to be a dancer. I don't mean to give that awful
I know what you mean,
cliche.
Though. But you're right.
Let him go in the direction that he wants, because then he's going to be excited by learning. If you force him into something that he doesn't like, or your daughter, they're going to develop that relationship to learning as if it's a drag, as it puts them off, and it becomes a habit where they feel like they're compelled to do something and everything's a compulsion. You want to encourage them to follow what they feel connected to. And it could be several things. For Yoki Matsuoka, it was tennis, because she was a really good tennis player, and it was math. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. Let her go those two paths. They were sort of different, but that's what she was drawn to.
And that's what I love about the Matsuoka story as well, is that the reason why she got into robotics was because she wanted to build a tennis-playing robot, which is such a little girl thing to come up with. But then she follows it, and the result is she has more PhDs than either of us do.
I got to give you props, Robert. I mean, it's such an important idea. And I know you write because it's your calling and stuff, but, you make a big difference. You know, people who take the time to really sweat over a book like this and get this idea out there, and nobody reads, man. No, this is one of the reasons we had this goddamn podcast.
But that's the thing. People say nobody reads, but he sold 1.2 million plus books.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
You know, so I mean, I think that's the thing is that people say that people don't read, but I think there's two things. One, people do read, right? Like, it's not just Harry Potter. People are reading books.
Right.
And the other thing is, too, is that people who do read then take on a sacred responsibility, which is to act as the intermediaries, and they start talking to other people, and they get them interested in those ideas, and they diffuse out into the culture,
Right, and that's what... But I just think that somebody who takes the time, as much time and the blood, sweat, and tears to write a book like this, and then really just take on the question and really put it out there. It's I appreciate it, man. I really just think it's an amazing. It's a. you know, I don't want to say it's this huge act of compassion because that's a little cheesy, but, you know, and I think you write because you had to get the idea out there. We write because there's an idea and you felt you could probably articulate it better than most people. And by the way, it hadn't really been written this way before and you wanted to get it out there. I get that, you know, and that's all good. But I just appreciate it, man. I just think it's a really important thing. It's the same thing with Straight Up Conspiracy. I mean, your book is about to get a wide distribution. And it's an idea that I think is desperately needed. And the reason I say that is when I grew up, I didn't know about this shit. Mm-mm. This was a mystery to me. Mastery, I thought, belonged to the magical.
Right.
Mastery belonged to the chosen few.
Right.
And I was not raised that the Straight Up Conspiracy, same thing with the book. I did not know that there was a way to deconstruct the learning process. I didn't understand why I couldn't learn something. Mm-hmm. I was just told to concentrate. Concentrate, focus, apply yourself. What the fuck are you talking about? I don't know what that means. Yeah. Give me examples.
Right.
All I would hear is, you know, they practice 8 hours a day. You'd be shamed into the fact that you were lazy. Mm. And so I remember as a very young kid, I was like, man, I'm never going to be historically significant. This sucks.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's why books like this, now that we're learning more and more about this stuff, and these studies are so important. It's a very important idea.
Well, and I think
it's how we should start our education.
Well, and I think that's the interesting thing is I think they're such beautiful complements to each other. Like, it really does feel like in writing this, you have really sort of rounded the circle. Because the thing that I found interesting is, you know, I was just reviewing the 48 Laws of Power this morning, and Law 30, make your accomplishments seem effortless. And so much of the reason why we really do believe that, you know, figures like Einstein are these magical creatures is because there's a lot of work goes into making things seem that are hard work seem as if they took no work.
Yeah, the example I use in the book, I think is my favorite example, is Bill Bradley, the basketball player. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people are old enough. He was great at Princeton in the 60s, and then he went on to become a New York Knick and all championships,
one
and then a U.S. senator. But Bradley, as a kid, loved basketball. He had a visceral sort of attraction to the sound of the going through the net. I don't know if I love basketball, and I had that same thing, just the sound of a swish.
Swish.
Yeah. You know, and just the bouncing of the ball on a hardwood floor. He just loved that. He had a feel for he loved the game, but he was white. And although he was tall, he couldn't jump. He was slow. He just was awkward.
Yeah.
And
slow twitch muscle. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but he wanted to become really good. And so he initiated his own private practice sessions. Nobody taught him this. He created these things where he made these glasses where he couldn't look at his feet. So he would practice dribbling for hours because you want to be able to dribble without having looking down so you can see the court and make passes.
Yep.
He practiced it for hours. And his family would go on a trip on a cruise ship. He would practice on the ship going around and around on in the narrow little passageways with his glasses and trying not to hit people. And he'd be, before he'd go to bed, he would practice what's the word? Not when you shift your foot. Pivoting. He practiced pivoting in his bedroom. He would set up chairs and dribble around them and everything. All these endless. Oh, he did this thing where he'd walk down the street and he would try to be able to see things on both sides so he could develop peripheral vision.
Obsession. An obsession. Yeah.
And it got to the point where he became so good when he was at Princeton, particularly the Knicks, that people thought, this guy is a magician on the court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was born this way.
It's like Larry Bird, same thing. They thought he had eyes in the back of his head.
They said he had eyes in the back of his head. How could he possibly have seen that man? How could he possibly have made that graceful move? How did he know where to be there to get that rebound? It was practice.
It was mastery.
Yeah.
But it was practice that nobody saw. And so they assumed
nobody
it never happened, which is not the same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually, yes, why I'm boxing or why I play tennis. I play a lot of tennis, and I just like playing with people who are really good because it's really fun to watch them. They can see things you're doing, but the way you get better is like with Wayne McCullough. I mean, when I hit with him, he doesn't use mitts. He uses gloves that are also mitts so he can hit you back. That guy's never letting me hit without him hitting back. Because what happens is you start learning how to catch and ride shots naturally.
Wow.
And so it's one thing to be able to hit mitts. Everybody can hit mitts. You learn how to throw your hands. I can teach you that, you know. But it's another thing to be hitting when another punch is coming at you or being able to hit and be ready immediately for the next punch.
Wow.
That's boxing.
Yeah.
And boxing isn't about throwing your hands. It's about where are you punching from.
Yeah.
And where are you recovering? And you're always moving, always moving.
Right.
And when you expose yourself to somebody who's that fluent and a master at that language,
yeah,
it's a thing of beauty. It's fun to just be part of it. It's fun to kind of touch it.
Yeah.
See it in real time. Uh-huh. And the other thing to your point, you don't learn how to box unless you actually are in a ring with somebody hitting you.
Yeah.
There's no way. You know, yeah. And life is that way.
Well, and I think one of the things that you're pointing at, and
I'm not a boxer, by the way, to everybody. Don't come up to me after my shows and be like, dude, you want to come? I'm not a boxer. Don't throw punches at me. I'll lose and I'll call the cops. I'm just talking about boxing as an example.
Yeah. But one of the things that, you know, you're really pointing to and that is so important in the book, and I think that is so reassuring, is the importance of a mentor.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Because so often, I mean, that's the thing, you know, part of the myth is not just the genius that did no work, but the lone genius who did it all by himself.
All bullshit. Yeah. You need somebody to show you how to practice, yeah. Correct practice, right?
Or they call it deliberate practice.
Deliberate, yes. Practice.
I have my own way of describing that, but...
Which is?
I forget the actual... God, I'm so in my memory today.
He hasn't read his own book. He hasn't.
He's so successful, he actually now has other people write it.
Robert Greene has other people write it.
That's right.
For him.
And then he has he's using the 30th law of power. He tells a story about the 11 weeks.
Yeah,
and now he had to work so hard.
Just a bunch of really hot girls who are super smart.
I wish, man. That's God. Yeah. That'd be my fantasy. No. It's called something like painful practice. I forget the word I use. Pardon me. But I'm... Deliberate practice is a great concept, yeah. Which is basically normally when people – it's not just 10,000 hours. It's the quality of the 10,000 hours right. That matter. So it's how you're practicing and what you're practicing. And most people tend to practice lopsided. They tend to repeat what they're good at. Mm-hmm. So you're good at throwing a right-hand punch. You're just going to be throwing right-hand punches left, right, and center because you don't want to practice your left hand because you're weak at it.
Yep.
And it's going to be boring to do that. Deliberate practice is finding what you're weak at. And focusing on that. So you don't have a lopsided practice. You have a rounded practice. Of course, that's brilliant and I agree with it. But I also say you want to embrace things that are painful and unpleasant in your practice. And in fact, if it's painful or I call it resistance practice. Thank you. I remembered my own words. Resistance practice. You want to practice those things that you resist doing. It's just basically the same way of saying deliberate practice.
Yeah.
You want to embrace the pain. It's going to be painful to be doing that.
How do you motivate yourself to do that? I mean, what would you say to somebody who, the middle-aged guy who wants to redo his life here? Because your book speaks to that. I mean, your book speaks to people. That is one of the reasons I think your books in general are so popular. It's one thing that these are not self-help books. I don't agree with that. I think they're actually scientifically based. One of the things I really appreciate about the books is the historical. You have such a command of history, and this is a scientific narrative as well. It's you know, these are tried and true principles. So I don't think they're self-help books. I think that they're more than that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, and so talk a little bit about inspiration and how do we get ourselves into that mindset.
Well, it depends on where you are in life. You know, yeah. I'm a realist and I'm a practical person. So it's not like a cookie cutter formula that I could spout out to you right now right. that will pertain to everyone. It depends on where you are.
Right.
So if you're 40 and you're sick of your job and you want a big change, okay, that's one thing. If you're 22 and you're about to enter the work world, that's a totally different other, you know, bit of advice.
Right.
But if you're that 40-year-old person, which is a lot of people coming to me like that, yeah. saying, I don't know what my calling is in life, and I hate my job. Help me. Basically, you have to go through a process. Everybody wants instant fixes now. You have to reconnect to yourself and to what you like and dislike and what you're good at and not good at. And it's going to take some introspection, which is something a lot of people don't like to do. You've got to go through it. It
takes resistance practicing.
Yeah. Connecting to what you liked when you were a kid, going back to those memories like you had that are really vivid and interesting about what you felt you were good at and what you were drawn to, and other things is a process, and I talk about it in the book. But the other thing, the most important thing, is to never abandon the past. So if you've spent, this is just an example, let's say you've been a lawyer and you hate law, which is a common scenario. And I don't blame you.
Especially corporate law.
Corporate law or banking.
Yeah.
Banking, I don't know what I could say about banking. But law, you know, you've learned some skills. You've spent 18, 15 years knowing how to argue, knowing how to write a brief, knowing how to organize your thoughts, knowing how to be an asshole, you know, whatever. You don't want to now suddenly then give that all up and go into poetry or become a rock musician. You want to build on things that you've already accumulated 6,000 hours of good practice and skills in something. What you need to do is adapt them now to a change in life that's not radical, but that's heading in the right direction.
Fulfilling. Mm-hmm.
So I have an example I give. I've repeated it a million times, but of a woman who was in that situation. She wanted to be a writer. She didn't quit and become a writer. She went into writing about legal things. And that was great. Now she's able to write about other things that she really loves. But you've got to first connect to who it is that you are and where that changes, and don't make some irrational, radical change in your life. You have skills and you want to build on them.
I always tell people
Grisham, right? I mean, you know, he was a lawyer. He wanted to get out of law, so he wrote law books, and now he writes about baseball.
Yeah, I always say another out is to figure out what you can do to help other people, make the world a better place. You've got this skill set, and I think there's a great deal of satisfaction a lot of times for people to figure out where there is a need for your skill set, where there is. Where your skill set is lacking, how you can change the world, and in a certain sense,
that's also just resistance practice because you're finding out what's not working in the world and you fix it.
It's called thinking and introspection, like you said.
But I think it's interesting because when we wrote about deliberate practice, we also didn't like the term deliberate practice. Uh-huh. It's not a very good intuitive term.
No.
It doesn't really tell you what it is.
No.
And the interesting thing is, I mean, the nice thing about resistance practice is that, again, it drives at the emotion.
Yeah.
The point is mistakes feel bad and they feel uncomfortable and you want to avoid them. And so you have to basically fight against that and go to the things that feel bad.
Well, the example I give that I think most people can relate to is if you do sports or you exercise. I exercise every day.
Duh.
Yeah. What? No, but I like I do things like swimming, you know, sort of sports by yourself.
Robert just takes his shirt off. Check this out. Jeez, what's your next body called? The Body?
I don't think so.
Robert Greene, the new book, The Perfect Body. And it's just pictures of you in different poses doing every different sport.
I don't think my mother would like that. I don't think anybody would like that. Anyway, what was I saying?
Sorry.
No, but when you do something like swimming or running or anything, any sport, it's painful. Let's just admit. You know, I swim long distances in a pool with chlorine and you have no thought, you know, you can't see or think about anything. It's tedious. Mm-hmm. Why do people do it? Because the feeling afterwards is great. And it's not just the feeling right afterwards. It's cumulative. So weeks, months, you look better, but your mind, you feel better. Mm. But you use the pain as knowing that it's going to result in something, a much higher kind of pleasure.
Right.
So that's how I say people, you relate. Let's say you're practicing the piano or chess or whatever. It's boring, but you can have the same thing as that happens when you exercise. It's going to happen with chess because it may not be immediate like with swimming. It's going to take 6 months. But, man, in a year, you're going to be so excited by what you can do. You know,
Bill T. Jones, the choreographer, said it's like when he first starts to dance and work on something, it's like getting into a tub of cold water.
Yeah.
And it just takes his body time to acclimate. But after a while, it's incredibly refreshing.
That's a great metaphor.
Yeah, it is. But every time you talk to people who've made studies of mastery or people who have mastered things, they always seem to be speaking the same language.
I know.
Right?
I know.
There is no shortcut. There is no mystery.
I know.
It is resistance practice. It's perfect practice. It's deep practice, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
It's good teaching, good tutelage, and it's getting yourself in the emotional state. But more importantly, maybe it's also following that primal urge, listening to that little voice as you say, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what I think you do so well in mastery. I think all your books should be required reading to a large extent, especially the 48 Laws of Power. We appreciate you coming on the podcast, man.
Well, God, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, you deserve it. You deserve all the praise we give.
Well, you've got a great show yourself. You've got a really great team here. So
thank
very
you,
impressed.
Sir. I give,
I'll spread the love.
I give at least half
spread
the credit.
The love.
Yeah,
spread
exactly.
The love.
Spread the love, man. Yeah, well, listen, seriously, when we have a guy like you on, it's really easy to get other people on, you know?
Okay.
If Robert Greene did your podcast, maybe I'll do your podcast.
That's right.
That's what you hear. So.
We'd love to have 50 on.
Yeah, let's get 50 on and talk about the other book. He's busy, but we'll see. But
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah,
no promises.
Yeah. Exactly. listen, thank you for joining us, man. You're welcome back anytime. If you want to talk about anything else,
anything.
I just drop in.
Just show up.
I swear to God, you can do that anytime you want.
All right.
You just show up and come out.
You might regret saying that.
Where in LA do you live?
Los Feliz.
Okay. You come out to a show sometime. I'm always doing stand-up.
I would love to, man. Yeah. I would love
to. Yeah. I'll get your information.
Okay.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's been the Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show. And that was the great Robert Greene sitting right next to me. He didn't die just now. That was the great car. He just passed away 2 seconds ago. So sad. From being too smart.
But then he used the 51st law of power, which is know how to resurrect yourself.
That's right.
Coming soon to a bookshelf near you. Peace.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.